Welcome, listeners. This is the Indie Week, the Independent, a weekly edition that read today by John Federson, and it's a production, of course, of the North Carolina Reading Service intended for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. And here we go. And our first two articles are from Durham Today. Members of the Durham Association of Educators, DAE, rallied ahead of the Durham County Commissioners meeting on Tuesday to share their 2 cents. Classified workers at Durham Public Schools aren't making enough to get by. Demonstrators from the Educators Union dominated a public hearing on the county's proposed 26-27 fiscal year budget, pleading with commissioners to allocate enough funding for classified workers to make a living wage before their final vote on June the 8th. DAE successfully lobbied the Durham Public Schools DPS Board of Education to include the pay raises in its budget request to the county. The board ended up asking Durham County for $28.5 million more in funding than it received for current fiscal year. DPS proposed budget included a 12% raise for classified workers, that is, non-teaching employees, which includes bus drivers, custodians, cafeteria workers, instructional assistants, and office staff. The raise would push DPS minimum wage from $17.15 an hour to $19.22, on par with Durham County's own minimum wage standard. But earlier this month, Durham County Manager Claudia Hager unveiled her recommended 26-7 budget that included a nearly $11 million increase in DPS funding. Not only was that less than half of what the district asked for, but it also didn't leave room for classified workers to get a raise, as DPS administrators say the increase would only cover the cost of maintaining current services. Asia Pope, a member of DAE leadership, said during this hearing, "Gas prices are rising, utilities are rising, everything about us is rising except for our pay." Hager proposed raising the Durham property tax by 2 cents to accommodate what would be an overall 67.67% increase to the county budget, calling the process a delicate balancing act between limited resources, resident economic stress, and nearly infinite needs. That presentation was May 11th for that proposed fiscal year budget. Before the hearing, though, began on Tuesday, about 30 attendees stood on the steps of the Durham County Government Building, clad in red DAE T-shirts, to once again push for that 12% raise, even if that means the county raising property tax by an additional 2 cents to fund it. Before entering the meeting, the group heard staff testimonies and repeated chants such as "one job should be enough," and "fighting for justice, fighting for our rights, fighting for our students, fighting for our schools." The meeting was DPS classified workers' chance to make their demands heard, face-to-face with the commissioners who would soon begin work sessions to dictate the next year of DPS county funding. Around 20 speakers took to the podium urging the county to fund classified staff pay, some sharing anecdotes about working multiple jobs to make ends meet and delaying medical care. Commissioners did not address the comments. Teacher assistant Carolyn Eubanks said, "I'm contemplating bankruptcy because I can barely pay my bills. The stress and uncertainty have left me feeling depressed." Advocates at the podium also expressed frustration that Durham County missed out on property tax revenue due to corporate housing investors in Durham not paying their fair share. President Mika Tweetmeyer told Indy, "Corporations evaded their taxes this year in record numbers by appealing their assessment values or claiming nonprofit status using a state loophole." The continued pressure on the county to bolster funding for public schools is not happening in a vacuum. The state legislature's 10 months long budget stalemate has caused fiscal uncertainty to fester. The state budget agreement announced on May 12th indicated an average 8% raise for teachers and an average 3% raise for state employees, which includes the classified workers. DAE equated the latter to next to nothing. Multiple speakers at Tuesday's meeting told commissioners they understand the legislature's underfunding of public schools has put the county in a difficult position, but stood firm in their call to action. Considering the county gave DPS a $20 million increase in 2024, that's shy of its $27 million request, a hefty increase this year would not be unheard of. Ahead of the rally and meeting, Tweetmeyer told Indy that she hoped commissioners would go home understanding the urgency of investing in classified workers so they will continue working for DPS. She said, "We know there's people waiting to see what will happen for next school year. Classified folks haven't received a pay increase in Durham in 2 years, so they're waiting to see if it's going to be another third year with no in pay increase before they look for alternative employment." After the commissioners convene for budget work on sessions on May 28th, June 1, and June 2nd, they are scheduled to vote to approve the final 26-7 fiscal year budget at the meeting on June the 8th. All right, as promised, next, another Durham article, this one about elections. They are omnipresent. In the odd years, city council and mayoral races take center stage, whereas the county commission, school board, state, and federal races ramp up in the even years. This marathon election schedule can be exhausting for nearly everyone involved, politicians and voters alike. That schedule could change substantially in the coming years. At Durham City Council work session last week, Durham Board of Elections Chairman David Boone and Elections Director Derek Bowens presented a slate of possible changes to council and mayoral elections that, if adopted, could reshape Durham politics. The four changes under consideration are moving council election to even-numbered years, creating a, quote, true ward system, extending the mayor's term to 4 years, and eliminating the primary in favor of a single, nonpartisan general election. A main driver for reconfiguring municipal elections in Durham would be cost. The city of Durham is responsible for reimbursing the county to administer the primary and general elections for mayor and council in these odd years. Those costs have jumped from $375,000 in 2017 to over $800,000 in 23 and 25. Over the past 5 years, the total of this cost has been $3,200,000. This does not include costs to administer ballots for the 614 Wake County and 42 Orange County residents who live inside Durham city limits. That totaled over $20,000 last year. The feeling of deja vu when you just cast a ballot for Durham City Council in October, then turn around less than a month later to return to the polls, it's not just you. Durham holds nonpartisan primaries and general elections for mayor and council. A member of any political party can file to run in the primary election, after which the top two vote-getters compete head-to-head in the general in November. Rarely do the outcomes change after that primary. The winner in October tends to hold on to 3 weeks later. Eliminating the primary in favor of a single general election would substantially reduce administrative cost and electoral exhaustion, as council members put it, from these back-to-back elections so close together. The change received broad support from the city council members during that discussion and seems like the most likely change to be adopted in the coming years. Next, the ward system. When Durham's ward system was first implemented, the assertion was that having council members from different parts of the city would diversify the board and prevent a concentration of power from one particular area. But because everyone votes in all ward races, residents can be outvoted by the general public. The ward system can give voters a false sense of representation, councillor said during the meeting. Councillor Chelsea Cook took the idea a step further, suggesting all six seats should move to a true ward system, shrinking the size of each ward's footprint, and making it easier to stay engaged with the councillor's specific constituency. And Cook said three wards to represent a city of this size feels just overwhelmingly not appropriate, because folks are not truly represented if they're bulked into with a third of the city. Fellow councillor Matt Kopeck, who assumed the Ward 1 seat last November, said he's open to the true ward system, but held reservations about the motives for the change. And he said, I want to make sure we're clear on the rationale and the criteria for moving to that, to make sure it's really based on data for the outcomes we're hoping to achieve, and not just the feelings we may have about that change. Councillor Carl Rist said he had serious concerns after talking with city councillors from around the country who warned that true wards could create parochial representatives who care more about their specific districts on issues like zoning cases rather than acting as a team for the city at large. During the discussion, Kopeck also expressed openness to expanding the number of seats on the council. That was an idea floated during public comment by former city council member Jacqueline Wagstaff, and went as far as saying the city should consider fully merging with the Durham Board of County Commissioners. That's similar to Charlotte-Mecklenburg. The city of Durham and Durham County have attempted board mergers twice before, in 1974 and in 2000. The mayoral terms. While the mayor has a few additional responsibilities, the position is ultimately one of seven votes as a member of the city council. But sitting at the head of the table comes with a drawback. A year after stepping into office, it's right back to campaigning to keep your job. In Durham, mayors are elected every 2 years, where their council colleagues get four-year terms. Durham's current mayor, Leonardo Williams, as well as Kopeck and Rist, spoke in favor of moving the term to 4 years. Williams called the compressed election cycle exhausting, while Rist said it was, quote, crazy to run on such a tight schedule. Councillor Nate Baker and Cook pushed back, saying 2-year terms for the mayor gives voters more frequent opportunities to express approval or disapproval with the city's top office. Cook said, I understand it's difficult to run an election. If you're doing a good job in your governance, that is part of campaigning as well. Now, Raleigh, Cary, and Morrisville operate with 4-year mayoral terms. Chapel Hill is the only other municipality with a 2-year term. That's the background on that. Well, what about even-numbered election years? Moving municipal election to even years would reduce election reimbursement costs by 70% or more, according to Boone. The Board of Election already administers ballots in even years for numerous federal and state elections, which tend to draw more voter participation because of the high visibility of the big-ticket races. The switch could boost voter turnout in local contests. Here's a sobering one. Since 2017, odd-year general election, average turnout, 19% of registered voters, compared to 64% for even years. But most of the council stood in opposition to this proposal. Councillor Shanetta Burris said local candidates, particularly women, could have a harder time fundraising if they have to compete in an expanded field of races. Baker added he is vehemently against moving to even-year races, saying local candidates would be overshadowed by the top of the ticket. Baker and others also said the odd years are an opportunity to register voters and educate the public leading up to these federal and state elections, and it frees city councilors to campaign on behalf of higher officer seekers in even years. Baker said, I get the exhaustion factor of having elections every single year, but I also think that it's almost like democratic maintenance, that when we pound the pavement in odd years, we're making sure that people are registered to vote. The city of Raleigh switched to even-year elections between 2019 and 2022, and the turnout has steadily risen. Marianne Baldwin won with 21,000 votes in 2019. And in 2022, she won with 71,000, while her successor, Janet Cowell, won with 132,000 votes in 2024. What comes next? The city council will have to get state legislative approval to move from even to odd elections, which Raleigh did in 22, but could amend the city's charter to administer the other changes. No timeline has been given for the council to take action. Mayor Pro Tem Javier Caballero, who presided over much of the discussion in the mayor's absence, said regardless of what changes council members consider, Durham voters should be the ones to make the ultimate decision. To me, she said, it would be a modernization of municipal elections, and we would put everything in front of the voters and let voters decide. Now, there is a small sidebar to this called Charter Changes, Method and Form of Election, and this talks about the timeline for doing any of these changes that were mentioned. Number one, council adopts a resolution of intent. Number two, calls for a public hearing. The date of this hearing must not be more than 45 days after adopting the resolution. It must be published at least 10 days prior to the hearing date and contain a summary of these charter changes proposed. Then the public hearing itself provides residents with the opportunity to be heard. And then four, adopt the ordinance which amends the charter following the hearing, but not earlier than the next scheduled regular meeting of council. And no later than 60 days from the date of hearing, the council may adopt the ordinance. They may choose then to subject the ordinance to a referendum and call an election. And finally, within 10 days after the ordinance is adopted, the notice of adoption must summarize the content and effect of the ordinance. If it's adopted without a referendum, a petition may be filed with the city clerk, etc., etc. So that's the five steps for changing Durham municipal elections and some other of these changes. This next article, published on the 21st, which was our last date of broadcast, I did not have a chance to read that, and so I'll read it now. Raleigh, UNC Health sent Wake Med Hospital an offer. The Raleigh Hospital says it's sticking with Atrium. Days after it became public that Wake Med intended to merge with the Charlotte-based Atrium Health, UNC Health sent Wake County System an offer. Wake Med quickly rejected it. UNC, though, is still open to negotiate. Atrium's plans to take control of Wake Med, an independent, nonprofit health system, made a splash in the region earlier this month. The two health systems quietly planned their merger over 2 years, but surprised elected officials in the region when the plans appeared as an item on a Wake County commissioner's agenda back on May the 1st. The county had planned to quickly approve its part of the merger at its May 4th meeting by tweaking legal documents from the asset transfer made in 1997 when Wake Med first changed from a public entity to an independent nonprofit. Wake County still retains some real estate reversion rights related to Wake Med. Instead of approving the legal tweaks as planned, commissioners agreed to a 90-day pause while health leaders held a series of listening sessions. State Attorney General Jeff Jackson's office also said it plans to review the transaction. WakeMed's hasty announcement of a proposed Atrium deal rattled leaders and lawmakers from both sides of the aisle. Healthcare consolidations over the past decade have sent costs for patients soaring as competition shrinks. The number of independently owned hospitals in North Carolina has shrunk from 53 to 20 since 2000. Health systems argue that strategic partnerships are a way to ward off mounting financial headwinds, but research suggests otherwise. At a media event on May the 5th, WakeMed CEO Donald Gintzig said the organization had fielded many offers over the years. He also insisted the hospital system was not, quote, for sale. UNC Health made an offer the same day, WakeMed confirmed. In a statement to the assembly, WakeMed spokesperson Kate Wilkes said the offer was unsolicited. The terms are unclear. Wilkes said that WakeMed carefully reviewed it, but it is sticking with Atrium. Quote, our board of directors conducted a thorough, deliberate 2-year evaluation process for the future of WakeMed, which included potential partners, and determined a strategic combination with Atrium Health is in the best interest of WakeMed and the communities we serve. The Triangle is home to 3 major healthcare players: Duke Health, based in Durham County, UNC Health in Orange County, and WakeMed in Wake County. A UNC-WakeMed combination would reduce competition, said Wilkes, bringing the number of health systems in the county from 3 to 2. UNC Health owns Raleigh's Rex Hospital, one of WakeMed's top competitors. She said combined, WakeMed and UNC Health would control 80% of the health care market in Wake County. We have heard from numerous stakeholders, including the state treasurer, that maintaining robust competition is important for our rapidly growing region. State Treasurer Brad Briner has been outspoken in his criticism of the Atrium WakeMed deal, as has State Auditor Dave Boliak and lawmakers representing the region. In 2018, UNC Health and Atrium backed out of a planned merger after regulatory inquiries, unable to agree on competing leadership strategies. Wilkes wrote, we have reviewed UNC's health proposal and we will continue engaging with the community regarding our path forward. At this time, however, that path lies with Atrium Health. Like WakeMed, Atrium grew from a county-owned hospital into a regional system. In 2022, the Charlotte system merged with the Illinois-based Advocate Aurora Health to form Advocate Health, which is now the nation's 5th largest nonprofit health system. Alan Wolf, spokesperson for UNC Health, confirmed the system expressed interest in a broader partnership with WakeMed and said it remains, quote, ready and willing to be a partner in whatever best serves the community. UNC Health and the UNC School of Medicine have a long-standing partnership with WakeMed to train medical students and residents. Roughly 30% of WakeMed's medical staff trained at UNC, according to Wolf. He wrote in a statement, we have been assured that this training partnership is important to WakeMed. It's because of this success we believe even greater things can be accomplished together for our citizens. That's precisely why we have expressed interest in furthering our relationship with WakeMed. Now, those listeners may or may not remember that the Indy Week, the Independent, has been acquired by a larger consortium or an agency that now manages its an editorial content and publication but also aligns it with several other area publications, the ones that where reporters introduce stories which are published in Indy Week. There's the overall, let's say, group called the Assembly, which is a network, and they have bought a year or two ago the Indy Week. And so some of the articles that I'll read to you come from there, not attributed necessarily to that, to a particular publication. Well, that's long-winded, but I'm going to read you an article from the Assembly itself, which relates to specifically the last article about healthcare that I was just reading. North Carolina's medical school boom. Alex Mostella drove by the construction site behind Cape Fear Valley Medical Center in Fayetteville every day for the past 2 years on his way to work as a medical scribe at an eye care clinic. When Mostella learned that the steel beams and paved lots would become the Methodist University Cape Fear Valley Health School of Medicine, his goal of becoming a doctor took shape. Mostella was among more than 1,500 applicants for that school's inaugural class that will start in July. He got in, along with 63 other students. Last month, as part of the school's Accepted Students Day, Mostella toured the now-completed facility, where he will spend the next 4 years working toward a medical degree. He said being able to see off in the distance this being built, and that's where the next stop is for you, that's where you want to go, it was an incredible experience, being able to walk into that building. The new medical school is the sixth in North Carolina. But there could soon be a seventh. The University of North Carolina, Wilmington, plans to open a medical school in 29. Meanwhile, Wake Forest University School of Medicine in Winston-Salem launched a campus in Charlotte last year. University and health officials say the new schools are necessary because North Carolina does not have enough doctors to care for the 11 million people who live in the state, particularly those in rural communities. The state is predicted to be short more than 7,000 doctors by 2030, said UNC Wilmington's Chancellor Aswani Voloti. And while the state faces a doctor shortage, the number of medical school applicants far outpaces the spots that are available. More than 32,000 people applied last year to the schools at UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, East Carolina, and Wake Forest, according to the AAMC, formerly known as the Association of American Medical College. That's 32,500. 600 were accepted. The UNC School of Medicine admitted 230 students last year, its largest ever class. East Carolina's Brody School will increase its first-year enrollment cap from 100 to 120 students in 2027 and eventually increase it to 160. North Carolina is not the only state experiencing a medical school boom amid record-breaking enrollment nationwide. The number of accredited medical schools in the U.S. grew from 123 in 2006 to 163 this spring, according to the AAMC. At least five new medical schools or campuses have been announced this year, from Florida to Indiana. Voloti said, "There's no question about the need or deficit in the state. While I can't fix the entire state's problems, at least I can address something in my region." Mostella, 33, didn't always plan on becoming a doctor. After graduating from Village Christian Academy in Fayetteville in 2011, he enrolled in college courses on and off while working as a freelance apparel designer for Adidas and other companies. He eventually earned an undergrad degree in biology in 2004 from Methodist University, a private school with more than 2,300 students. But when COVID-19 began, Mostella said he felt called to help others in a new way. So he applied to Campbell University's Jerry Wallace School of Osteopathic Medicine in 24, but didn't get in. He took a job at Cape Fear Eye Associates to get medical experience. Methodist University Cape Fear Valley Health School of Medicine is a short drive from Mostella's home, where he lives with his wife and two children. He said, growing up, I wouldn't have thought anyone would have seen merit in putting a medical school in a place like Fayetteville, not because it didn't need one, because sometimes when you're from a place, you have a more narrow scope of it. Dr. Hershey Bell, the medical school's founding dean and the Cape Fear Valley Health Vice President and Chief Academic Officer, said opening a medical school is a matter of pride. The health system is the eighth largest in the state, with eight hospitals in Bladen, Cumberland, Harnett, and Hoke counties. Quote, for the health system and the community to realize that of the only 160 or so medical schools in the entire nation, one exists in our city, county, region, that's awe-inspiring. It's also about meeting a critical need. Many counties in eastern North Carolina are among the least healthy in the state. Nearly every county east of Interstate 95 is considered a health professional shortage area by the United States Health Resource and Service Administration. 13 counties don't have any general surgeons, according to the NC Health Professions Data System. 11 don't have a single OBGYN. The region has disproportionately high death rates from conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. Residents born in eastern counties like Robeson and Edgecombe have some of the lowest life expectancies in the state, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. Vorderly said UNC Wilmington, 115 miles from Fayetteville, has long aimed to address the shortage of healthcare workers in the southeastern corner of North Carolina. He sees a new medical school as an effective way to meet the challenge. And the UNC Board of Governors voted Thursday for the project to move forward. Wendy Murphy, chair of the Board of Governors, quote, UNCW has spent decades building strength in the health sciences and forging deep community partnerships. This is a thoughtful, future-focused opportunity to expand students' access to medical education, strengthen the healthcare workforce in the region, and create lasting impact across North Carolina. UNC Wilmington predicts that more than 2,000 students will apply to the school's inaugural class. 60 will be accepted and will work toward a traditional 4-year medical degree or finish on an accelerated 3-year track. Volati said, currently an inadequate number of medical school spots is hindering qualified students from becoming the state's next crop of doctors. Quote, you have to grow your own. Expanding access locally helps retain the talent locally and also strengthens the future physician workforce where it is needed the most. Jeffrey Young, who leads AAMC's Transforming the Healthcare Workforce Unit, described the nation's medical school applicant pool as strong. The average applicant in 25 had an undergraduate GPA of 3.67. and an MCAT admission test score of 506 out of 528, slightly higher than in prior years. While North Carolina's medical school applicant pool grew by 58% and became more competitive over the last 12 years, the number of seats increased by less than 22%. But is it possible for Eastern North Carolina to have too many medical schools? Bell said there is, quote, room and need for multiple institutions. Healthcare workforce shortages are not challenges one institution can solve alone. Fayetteville is the sixth largest city in the state, and Wilmington has experienced major growth in recent years. Nearby Brunswick County is one of the fastest growing counties in the nation, its population increased 4.7% just in the last 2 years. But much of the region is home to farmland and small communities. It can be tough to recruit and retain medical professionals to rural areas where salaries typically lag behind those in bigger cities, and some hospitals lack cutting-edge technology. Officials with North Carolina Medical School say they want to enroll in-state students who will hopefully stick around to serve their own communities. Methodist University offers 2 scholarships for students from southeastern North Carolina who want to pursue a medical degree. It has another scholarship for Cumberland County residents. East Carolina opened its medical school seats to out-of-state applicants for the first time last year, but North Carolinians still make up 100% of its incoming 91-person class. Dr. Jason Higson, dean of the medical school for ECU, says the Brody School of Medicine has a very specific mission that appeals to those who go into the profession to heal and care for people who need us most, often the most vulnerable communities in any place, including right here in North Carolina, rural communities, and residents who are historically underserved by medicine. 39% of North Carolina's medical graduates remain in the state, according to research in 2015. Dr. L. Ebony Boulware, Wake Forest University School of Medicine's dean and chief academic officer at Advocate Health, said by training physicians in the communities they serve, both urban and rural, we increase the likelihood they will remain in the state, helping improve access to high-quality care statewide. Next, postgraduate training. On average, North Carolina's 5 medical schools that offer Doctor of Medicine degrees saw almost 30% of graduates stay in-state for postgraduate residency training this year. UNC School of Medicine had the highest percentage, with around 45%, according to the school's match day results, followed by East Carolina School with 42%. Wake Forest University's had the lowest, about 28.5%, and match day, by the way, is the annual day in March when medical students learn where they will go for residency. About 21% of last year's Brody School of Medicine graduates accepted jobs at ECU Health in Greenville, according to Higginson. He said half of them choose primary care specialties, which are severely lacking in the region. And Higginson said, our school was started in the 1970s with a very specific mission: raise the number of primary care physicians for the state. Young with the AAMC said the cap on the number of residency positions funded through Medicare, quote, remains a major bottleneck to producing more doctors. Medicare is the largest federal funder of graduate medical education, according to the Government Accountability Office. In 1997, Congress set a per-hospital cap on the number of Medicaid-funded residencies to prevent a surplus of physicians. Now there aren't enough residencies to fill the nation's projected shortfall of up to 86,000 physicians in the next 10 years. Without expanding grad medical capacity, additional graduates do not translate into additional practicing physicians. This year, nearly 90% of the 1,100 available positions in North Carolina were filled, according to data from the National Resident Matching Program. The state is creating more residency programs through funding from the UNC System Office and the Federal Rural Health Transformation Program. Nearly 65% of physicians who complete both medical and residency in North Carolina stay in the state to practice. Since UNC Wilmington does not have an affiliated hospital, it will likely rely on Novant Health, Goshen Medical Center, and other partners to offer residency positions. They will also provide students with clinical placements during medical school. Valetti said, my goal is that southeastern North Carolina will be a net exporter of doctors versus the net import that we currently are. Laurie Whalen, president of acute care operations for Novant Health Coastal Region, is optimistic that Wilmington's medical school students will stay in the area to practice. That has been the case with the university's nursing program. Novant Health retained more than half the program's nurses last year, up from about 25% in previous years. Cape Fear Valley Health has about 75 residency positions for doctors available annually, said Bell, and more are in the works. Mostella said he's especially interested in the ophthalmology program the health system is considering, and ultimately, he said, he hopes to stay in Fayetteville. Quote, if I can continue my training over the course of my career here and then begin my career as a physician here, in a perfect world, that would be what I want. Next, from UNC Chapel Hill, the trustees have rejected the hiring of a tenured women's studies professor. The rare move comes a year after the board delayed dozens of votes to confer tenure, sparking outcry from faculty. They voted against hiring and granting tenure to a woman studies professor who had gone through the university's standard hiring process. That's an escalation of the board's actions against lifetime appointments that are considered a hallmark of academia. Kieran Asher, the former chair of the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at University of Massachusetts Amherst, was set to be hired as a distinguished professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies. Asher's potential hiring had been considered and approved by the Women's Studies Department, the College of Arts and Sciences, which houses the department, and a committee overseeing the appointment and tenure process. On Wednesday, she was part of a slate of six professors that the Board of Trustees considered for new tenured appointments. The board takes the final vote on all tenure cases after the provost signs off, according to a presentation that former interim provost Jim Dean gave the trustees last summer. But when the board emerged from its closed session on Wednesday, it only approved five of those outside hires, plus more than 25 promotions from within the university and a joint appointment. They considered Asher's appointment separately, and the majority of the trustees voted against hiring her in a voice vote. Two trustees, Ralph Meekins and student body president Devin Duncan, told the assembly they had voted in favor of that appointment. The trustees did not name Asher or the other professors up for appointment or promotion during the public votes because they were personnel matters. Multiple people told the assembly that Asher was the singled out case. In a Thursday email to the Advisory Board for Women's and Gender Studies Department obtained by the Assembly, the interim chair, Tanya Shields, said Asher's tenured hire was rejected. Quote, I do not have any information regarding the reasoning, and when I asked whether an appeal was possible, I was told it is not. Dean Stoyer, Chapel Hill's Vice Chancellor for Communications, said the university would not, quote, acknowledge the name of the person who was denied tenure, quote, but he confirmed in an email that there is not an appeals process for tenure approvals after the trustees' votes. Asher told the assembly she learned her case had been denied when she saw her name was not included on the list of approved personnel actions after that meeting. She had applied for the job when it was advertised last academic year, looking for a change after more than a decade at UMass, and excited about the possibility of returning to North Carolina after earning her master's degree at Duke in 1990. She said everything about it was aligning really well. Last week, though, Asher received a call from Provost Magnus Egerstedt, who told her he was going to put her higher up for the board's approval. Egerstedt assured Asher that her research and dossier were, quote, fine, she said, but, quote, he was concerned because of the Board of Trustees for new hires at senior levels wanted to know about return on investment. Some trustees have criticized the common university practice of offering lifetime appointments to experienced professors, which is intended to protect their ability to conduct research without fear of repercussions. Some trustees have expressed concerns about the salary costs that such appointments demand of the university over time. Beth Morocco, chair of the Chapel Hill faculty, said that argument, quote, doesn't hold water. She noted Dean's presentation last July outlined to the board that tenure builds stability and reduces costs associated with heavy turnover in faculty. Responding to a question from Trustee Jim Blaine about whether there were arguments against tenure, Dean noted that tenure does impose a, quote, financial encumbrance on the university. Morocco argued financial concerns about tenure should be addressed before jobs are posted, not after candidates have been vetted. If it's a cost savings, she said, then it needs to happen much earlier in the process. Duncan, student body president, said he believes that cases that make it through tenure process should get the board's approval unless they receive new information about the candidate, quote, that would make that person unworthy of consideration. That's why I voted yes, and I think that should be equally and standardly applied upon all candidates. Asher, whose UMass Amherst biography describes her as a biologist turned social scientist, was also seeking to join the women's studies at a fraught time for programs that study particular racial or gender groups. Last September, a women's studies professor was denied tenure at Harvard University, and some faculty there worried the move was evidence that the field would receive less support under the Trump administration. Asher said, these are very strange times. All kinds of things we fought against are being overturned. Morocco said the board's vote was part of a disturbing pattern that has emerged in recent years and could damage the university's standing. And to refresh our memories, tenure was at the center of the university's botched hiring of a journalist, Nicole Hannah-Jones, in 2021. The journalism school had recruited Hannah-Jones, known for her work on the New York Times Magazine 1619 project, to serve as a night chair, a prestigious professorship that typically comes with tenure. But the Board of Trustees chose not to take action on her tenure package, instead offering her a 5-year fixed-term appointment after which she could be reconsidered for tenure. That episode lit a firestorm at UNC Chapel Hill and became a national controversy. The board later reversed course and voted 9-4 to grant the tenure, but she turned UNC Chapel Hill down and opted to accept a night chair position at Howard University instead, and UNC Chapel Hill later paid her nearly $75,000 to avoid a discrimination lawsuit. More recently, the board delayed votes to confer tenure to dozens of faculty last spring. The assembly obtained an email in which then-Provost Chris Clemens wrote that Chancellor Lee Roberts had signed off on the measure to cut costs amid threats to funding at the state and federal levels. The board approved those cases after 2 weeks of outcry from professors. Morocco said, these events around tenure is a huge blow to the university's reputation, and also it's going to make recruitment and retention of world-class faculty more difficult. Stoyer disputed that trustees' recent action amount to a recurring pattern. He noted the board has conferred tenure to more than 290 professors since 2022. Quote, as we've said repeatedly, tenure is a competitive imperative for Carolina. The university remains committed to recruiting and retaining top faculty and consistently reviews salaries and benefits to align offers with both our budget and current relevant market data. Nothing has changed in the tenure policies. Asher still has her job at UMass, where she has been on leave this year finishing a book. She said it was too early to say if there might be another opportunity to move to Chapel Hill or if she would accept it if there was. She said the Chapel Hill Women's Studies Department has been supportive, and she worries about the vote against her hire might signal for the faculty there. She also cautioned that other schools might follow suit. what the UNC Board of Trustees did today, she said, other boards can do tomorrow. Well, I'm pleased to be able to give us a straight-ahead cultural review or report. And this is concerned with Fred Joyner. And he's the former poet laureate of Carrboro. And he is releasing a book, The Mirror in Our Music. And the release party for this book is scheduled for June the 4th, 7 p.m., Shadow Box Studio in Durham. And the article called Side A, A Music You Can See. When Fred Joyner was a kid in the 80s, his father was a house musician at Philly Soul Hotspot Sigma Sound Studios. Joyner says, basically, any music that came out of Philadelphia, if there was a trombone, my dad was probably on it. He was sitting in his book-stuffed living room in Carrboro. At age 51, the poet laureate finally has his own tome in the stacks, The Mirror in Our Music. That's a collection recently published by the Raleigh Small Press Birds, LCC. He goes on, and his soft, warm, even rasp, my father has a very distinctive sound. He once told me, you want to play the center of the note. His parents happened to be in the next room, a kitchen full of yellow balloons from his younger daughter's 10th birthday. The emotional center. When you hear a musician who's hitting it, it's transformative. Like father and like son. The poems in The Mirror in Our Music are spare and elemental, seldom longer than a few etched stanzas. Restlessly broken lines snap and curl on the page like reliefs on a gallery wall. Spacing guides the eye, not the breath. Joyner says, I view my poems as a visual art as much as a literary art. A lot of what I do is collage. Reading straight across one poem, On Why Duke Did Not Win the Pulitzer Prize in Music, clearly pursues its theme, and this is a quote from this poem, perhaps because some note refused to be flattened, some only exist in the hot moment, the crash of breath and bone. But those lines are riven into two columns, pulling the eye downward, hitting at secret mazes of meaning. The writing dazzles, but Mirror in Our Music contains so much more. Joyner encrusts his poetry with color photos, drawings, essays, epigraphs, and annotations. Done up in a square trim like a vinyl record, the book has an A side, which grew out of Joyner's graduate school thesis. You flip it for the B-side, which features his ekphrastic writing. I'm going to spell that E-K-P-H-R-A-S-T-I-C, ekphrastic. Poetry responding to other works of art. That's an interest he curates on his website, Black Ekphrastic. The B-side crackles with vernacular photos from the Ackland Art Museum exhibit and powerful self-portraits by photographer Iwane Samuel Njakwa. What do I want people to know about me? He considered while assembling this collection. Well, I want them to know that I have a love for African diasporic culture and music, that I'm adept at collaboration, that I'm open. So, the book is about jazz and moves like jazz. It's about the mysteries of art. How, quote, the grayscale song of a camera's eye says what our words cannot, unquote. It's an atlas of everywhere Joyner has lived or visited, from the nation's capital to North Carolina, Ireland to Africa, an ode to every artist, teacher, and ancestor that made a mark on him, the ones he makes marks for. Most of all, it's a hymn to community and collaboration. Almost every page is to, for, or about another person, or intimately dialoguing with their art. Chris Tonelli, the founder of the publisher, Birds LLC, said there was a lot of ground to cover and people to include, and I think that's the heart of it. Fred is a selfless, generous, open human being, and the book is ultimately a thank you note, not an opportunity to shine a light on his own work, but to lift up his friends and family and the artists who have shaped him. Joyner says, poetry for me is about the people who have poured into me. This book does not happen without music. It doesn't happen without art. It doesn't happen without any of that. Side B, The Man in the Mirror. Joyner published his first poem in the magazine of his Quaker middle school. All he remembers is that it was called Gabriel's Horn. Each contributor also included a poem that inspired them. Then he chose a spoken word piece called Silence by the straight-edge hardcore band Uniform Choice. Punk rock was his bedrock then. As a church kid in suburban New Jersey, as a high schooler at a rigorous college prep academy in Connecticut, and as a dazzled newcomer to Washington, D.C., bands like Bad Brains and Minor Threat went with his passion for skateboarding. It's easy to picture him hammering handrails, his stance low, and rolling like a boxer's. My parents are going to hear this, but I'm sure they know. Said we would get on the train and go into Philly to skate, and they had all ages, middle-of-the-day punk rock shows. The genre's epigrammatic defiance still lingers below the blue notes and improvisatory fights of his poems. Hands up, do not always mean surrender. Sometimes it is a call to arms. Living in D.C. blew his world open. Studying math at American University, he buried himself in poetry and art classes and the cultural life of the city. I would go to readings, slams, open mics, art shows, everything, he remembers. I would go to a hip-hop open mic, and the next day, I'd be at the Folger Shakespeare Library. And sadly, I must discontinue this article because my time is approached its end. So, this Indie Week will exist as a broadcast for infinity. After the Friday initial airing, it becomes a podcast. But beyond that, the whole article, including photographs and other excerpts from this book, is on IndieWeek.com. That's a free presentation of the publication that comes out about every week. So I'm John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service, thanking you, by the way, for listening to us, and we will be with you again next week. So bye-bye from ncreadingservice.org.